What kind of person blows the whistle on bank fraud and tax evasion, is fired, hounded, and prosecuted, and then doubles down and does it again? What kind of person takes on one of the biggest, oldest, and most important banks in Europe, takes its best shot, and then the best shot of the Swiss government, and does it again? A whistleblower, that's who. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Our next guest is an activist, a whistleblower, and a former Swiss private banker. Rudolf Elmer worked as a banker for Swiss banking powerhouse Julius Baer, eventually heading the bank's Caribbean operations in the Cayman Islands from 1994 to 2002. In late 2001, Julius Baer's internal security discovered that some internal data had been downloaded, and it required that every employee submit to a polygraph exam. These internal documents were proof that the bank was involved in fraud and in international tax evasion. When initially approached, Rudolf didn't take the polygraph exam for health reasons, but he took it later and he failed. The bank had a policy at the time that any employee who failed the test would be fired and his employment was terminated. But he still had custody of the documents on a thumb drive. In 2005, Rudolf sold a Swiss business newspaper a CD with 160 megabytes of data on it, but was almost immediately arrested in Zurich on suspicion of violating bank secrecy laws. He sat in custody for 30 days and started a website for whistleblowers as soon as he was released. In 2008, the German magazine Der Spiegel revealed that Rudolf was the source of documents that had recently appeared on the WikiLeaks website. These documents revealed that Julius Baer had held their customers' funds by funneling them through offshore accounts to increase profits and to avoid Swiss taxes. Julius Baer denied the allegations, but Rudolf responded by personally handing over to Julian Assange additional information on 2,000 account holders that came from three banks, including Julius Baer. In January 2011, Rudolf went on trial for violating bank secrecy laws, coercion, and attempted blackmail. He was convicted and sentenced to 2 years probation and a fine of 5,600 euros. What authorities didn't know was that Rudolf, just 2 days earlier, had provided WikiLeaks with yet more information. So on the day of his conviction, he was arrested again and charged again with violating bank secrecy laws. A second trial was held in November 2011, but the prosecution was not able to prove that Rudolf had actually violated any laws. In the end, even the Swiss and German media agreed that this was a complex case, and Rudolf Elmer is a complex person. One newspaper said, quote, "Rudolf Elmer is the model case of a whistleblower. He's no angel, but almost all whistleblowers are complex cases," unquote. We're glad to have Rudolf Elmer joining us today. Rudolf, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John, for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to talk about Switzerland and its judicial system and the banking world.
We're happy to have you. And I'm interested to know how this whole thing got started. You had a job that would be the envy of most people. You represented a major bank in the paradise that is the Cayman Islands, but you saw something that shook you into action. Tell us about that.
My job is concerned. I was a kind of a jack in all trades. So I was chief operating officer, accountant, compliance officer, currency and securities trader, and investment manager for hedge funds, private equity funds, and top of it, an expert in IT and Cayman Islands. Now, I had several shocks to deal with. It's not just only one. The first one is the shock that I was fired based on a criminal lie detector test. What right does the bank have to request that all staff has to perform a polygraph test and make this a condition a day before the polygraph test to continue to work for the bank? What right do they have to put up human beings to machines and use the machine to destroy someone's professional life? Is the bank the police, a prosecutor, even the FBI or the CIA, or even worse, a serious criminal? The next shock was when I was reviewing the backup tapes of the bank, I learned that the trust company department, not the company, trust department, served a Mexican police officer and drug dealer and murderer, Bin Laden constructionists, and many other criminals. There was plenty of fraud and even suspected terror financing. But there was no doubt the bank advised the clients how to commit crimes and was using its Julius Baer Group security portfolio held in the Caymans to evade taxes. On top of it, KYC was clearly no issue or simple was overwritten by the president of the Julius Baer Group. I know the client. He is clean. That is or was called KYC in those days. The third shock I had was related to 9/11, which happened 12 months before the lie detector test. And I often traveled to the US to conferences or to New York's office and so on. The bank accused me in the California court of making threats in the sense of 9/11, when the court dealt with WikiLeaks and the First Amendment of the United States, free speech and free press. The purpose was to destroy my credibility or even eliminate me with the help of the United States. I felt sooner rather than later, I end up in Guantanamo Bay. Fortunately, the U.S. Senator Carl Levin and the chief investigator of the U.S. Senate protected me and understood what was really going on. Fourth shock, in 2000, I could even prove an attempt of murder, me in the Cayman Islands. Luckily, I survived. I had threats from the bank, such as, better go for a deep dive, it's better for your family to cooperate, etc. So these are the things which shocked me, really.
I have to admit that I was surprised by the quickness with which the bank realized that somebody had accessed documents. How did that happen? And how was the bank able to identify you so quickly?
When I returned to Switzerland, I informed naively the Swiss tax authorities and prosecution and later the Swiss media about what is going on in the Cayman Islands. This was a terrible mistake I made, because I believed they would protect me and, most importantly, my family. There is today no doubt that the authorities informed the bank and the Swiss newspaper who sent the data in order to have it published. The publishing never happened in Switzerland, by the way. The newspaper provided the data officially to the bank and reported about my person. I am a mentally sick person, a criminal. I'm out only for revenge, etc., but nothing about the criminal clients and the dubious business, which was clearly explained on the data. In other words, I have steered up a hornet's nest of Zurich tax authorities, police, prosecutors, judges, and Swiss journalists who all protected the golden calf of Swiss bank secrecy. I exposed the truth, the true face of Switzerland, I think. A friendly judge wrote to me when I was in prison, and he wrote, "You are a bigger threat to the Swiss system than the Red Army, the IRF, etc., to the world, because you use information and no violence." That is what the bank offered me, a lot of money. The bank offered me a lot of money and offered me to close all criminal cases against me if I keep silent. Correct. The bank had the power to close all legal cases against me. What does it tell you? However, I'm not a person who accepts hush money. I rather prefer to go to prison.
You appear to have made a decision very early on that you were going to tell the truth about what was happening at Julius Baer. Consequences be damned. And certainly things devolved quickly for you. Tell us about your personal situation at the time. Were you married? Did you have children? Did you have to go through this experience alone? How did you handle the pressure of the bank essentially falling on your head and the Swiss authorities seeking to have you locked up in a jail?
Now, about making a decision or making my decision, I could not even make such a decision. I was forced to go public. I needed the protection of the public because the bank and the authorities used criminal methods to harass, to stalk, and to threaten me and my family. My family received death threats, even my six-year-old daughter. The bank expensed approximately, which I learned from the lawyer of the Julius Baer Bank, about $1.5 million using private detectives to perform psychological terror for several months. For instance, my daughter did not want to go to the school anymore because, in her words, black men approached her and offered chocolate. There was a car chase where my wife and my daughter was followed on the highway in Zurich. Private detectives drove at 10 p.m. in our dead-end road and made noise. Our neighbors were afraid, but the police and prosecution looked the other way. They stated to the neighbors simply, a person is observed and everything is fine. To go through the experience alone, I was entirely on my own with my with two exceptions. And these are the real heroes of this story. It's my wife and my daughter who kept me for not going mad, because I was already suffering from a severe post-traumatic stress disorder confirmed by leading medical experts. On the other hand, the Victim Support of Switzerland, or Human Rights Watch, or the NGOs, well-known politicians, playing things down. It was and still is a hornet's nest. If you blow the whistle in Switzerland today, I handled the pressure. The way I handled the pressure were several factors. I'm a real religious person. I had a brilliant psychologist who coached me, an exceptional Tibetan lady lawyer who fighted in the courtroom like a lion for its offspring, and great support when I was 3 months in a Christian mental home. There, I learned to think like the German hero Dieter Bonhoeffer, or who fought the Nazis, to think like Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And all this opened my eyes. Methods used against me were the same as in Nazi Germany against Jewish people, except they could not kill me. I was already a well-known public figure. It became crystal clear that I and my family were targeted, and Swiss judicial authorities and the government were going outside the law, abusing their position in order to target innocent people. I understood the modus operandi used for decades in Switzerland to fight truth tellers. And in recent cases like Bradley Birkenfeld, UBS, Harry Fanciani, related to HSBC Geneva, Trevor Kitchen, Yasmin Montagemi, Nestle, and many others. The obvious reason was that I was trying to teach and protect society about things which should never become public in a democratic state. A democratic state known as a role model for democracy. In my view, it's not a role model because it's run by an elite of gangsters. This fact hurts me, hurts my heart as a former captain of the Swiss Army, but it is the truth.
Thank you, Rudolf Elmer. Stay right there. We're speaking with Swiss banking whistleblower Rudolf Elmer about his revelations of Swiss bank Julius Baer's involvement in fraud and tax evasion. When we come back after this short break, we'll get into some of the specifics of his whistleblowing. Stay with us.
In the second half of the 1940s, the powerful European armies were losing their colonies. One of the first to start collapsing was the Dutch Empire. On August 17, 1945, the Declaration of Independence of Indonesia, a former Dutch colony, was proclaimed. The liberation movement was led by the national hero of the Indonesian people, Sukarno. However, Amsterdam had its own plan, which was to defeat the revolution. Moreover, they were supported by Great Britain. The colonial troops set up control over the main cities in the country. But the countryside remained in the hands of the rebels, and the resistance continued growing. In 1946, the British left Indonesia, whereas the Dutch did not want to lose power, and switched to the tactics of total terror. In December 1947, the royal troops committed a massacre of the inhabitants in the village of Rabagade. 431 civilians were killed. All in all, the lives of 100,000 Indonesians were on the conscience of the Dutch colonialists and their allies. Mass executions and regular bombing did not help the Netherlands. Their troops got blocked in the cities. The world community demanded to put an end to violence, and the empire started negotiations. In 1949, the Hague Roundtable Conference was held, and the Kingdom of the Netherlands was forced to recognize the independence of Indonesia. A sovereign Muslim state appeared on the world map and became one of the most powerful countries in the Islamic world.
Страх, конечно, присущ каждому. Кто же не боится на войне? Не боится только дурак. Всегда была граната. Мне вопрос сейчас задают, а почему одна она живет? Ну, ни туда, ни сюда. Да потому что я бы в плен не захотел сдаваться. Врагов может быть много. А противник на том участке ответственности, который тебе доверили, вот именно там находится противник. Выходишь из боя, и, конечно же, я чувствую только гордость. Для меня, конечно, смысл жизни – это защита своего родины, своего дома.
I look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Rudolf Elmer. He's a whistleblower who revealed to the world Swiss banking giant Julius Baer was involved in fraud and tax evasion through its offices in the Cayman Islands. Good to have you with us, Rudolf.
Yeah, thank you being here again and speaking about the financial industry of Switzerland or in Switzerland in general.
Rudolf, tell us a little about the nature of your whistleblowing. You did it over the course of several rounds, so to speak. What was the initial information and what did you do with it?
The initial information was about the way Julius Baer handled the trust, the business in the trust department in the Cayman Islands. And that's the way when I learned how things worked and studied the details in the trust department on backup tape. But the backup tape, actually, I was lucky in the sense that I had that backup tape at home because the bank requested me to take every day a backup tape home in order to use it in case if there's a fire in the bank. So I studied that data, but initially I also can say that I challenged management quite often in the bank and even in Zurich, and I really felt there's something going on, which I can't accept, but they didn't really take notice. Then I requested a evaluation of my professional performance, and which was brilliant, actually, except one sentence. They said, I'm a critical thinking person. So that basically was the starting point.
Concurrently with your first trial, you sent additional information to WikiLeaks. Or did you? One version that I saw was that you turned over to WikiLeaks a disk that was blank. Can you walk us through that? Was there a second revelation to WikiLeaks? And if so, what did that include?
Now, you're talking about the handing over of two CDs in the Frontline Club of London when Julian Assange was there. So those two CDs had no data on it. There was only a song about whistleblowers. I'm not that stupid to hand over data publicly when the world press is there, because I had to assume that English police who's entered the show and say, look, give us the CDs. So the idea of that handing over was to make public aware of the legal trial in Switzerland 2 days later. That was one purpose of it. The second purpose was, and the data was there, definitely. It wasn't only data of Julius Baer, it was also data of other banks and so on. My legal support of the US stopped the handing over of the real CDs in order to make sure, because they knew that what's going on in Switzerland, that I went already to prison, and they didn't want to give them more evidence to go after me. So it actually was a protective measure. But on the one hand, on the other hand, it was really a marketing event to show, to put the spotlight on the trial in Switzerland, because it was about Swiss bank secrecy. And the world press actually turned up in Zurich.
Explain to us what happened in court in your second trial. The prosecution essentially just fell apart. What happened there?
What really happened is is the fact that my employment contract, which was confiscated by the prosecution office and kept hidden for 7 or 8 years, because this contract really showed that I was employed in the Cayman Islands, and that it's not possible to apply Swiss bank secrecy in the Cayman Islands to an employee who is employed in the Caymans. That employment contract actually, by accident, was handed over to me by the police officer, handing over some data and binders which they had confiscated. And we actually, my lawyer took then that employment contract to legal experts of the in Switzerland. One of them was even a federal judge in employment law. And they wrote the second opinion, which actually Professor Mark Peet, who is known in Switzerland as one of the most well-known experts in money laundering, wrote that you can't apply the Swiss bank secrecy in the Caymans. That's not possible. So even so, they found me guilty again in 2014, but in 2016, at the higher court of Zurich, which is the second level, they had to change the verdict. I mean, and they really understood what's going on, and therefore the judges of the lawyer court, they actually were this way part of the dirty game.
Thank you, Rudolf Elmer, for joining us and for sharing your harrowing story of whistleblowing. We'll leave it there. And thank you to our viewers for joining us. Whistleblowing is tough. It's very tough. In many cases, it takes over our lives and changes their very course. But as the great industrialist Henry Ford said, quote, "Obstacles are those frightful things you see when you take your eyes off your goal," unquote. That's why in the end, whistleblowers are so often successful, even when the cost is very high. The goal is bigger than we are. The goal is the public good. That's why we do it. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.